You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
To Before They Were Live, an ongoing, monthly, and extremely nerdy conversation through the land of fairy, or the perilous realm. In his seminal essay on fairy stories, J.R.R. Tolkien says he has, quote, hardly been more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land, full of wonder but not of information. We take the same tack. We are, as ever, interested in playing our part in a healthy ecosystem of art and criticism and fandom, paying attention to the ways stories have shaped our collective imaginations. We're also slurpers of soup, happy to ladle out a bowlful from the great cauldron of story that has been bubbling and brewing for centuries. W.H. Auden said, art is our chief means of breaking bread with the dead. So pull up a chair to our table, grab yourself a soup bowl, a big old chunk of homemade bread, and help us enrich this reading experience and have some fun too. Today is our seventh and final episode of our Brothers Grimm fairy stories. I just realized as I read that this is that's nice that it falled on seven for fairy tales. But we have 10 more doozies for you. A few may be familiar, a few may not be. We will retell them here if you haven't read them. Joining me as always, it's Michael Farmer. You know, Michael was just over at my house for dinner last night, but when the dishes were put before him and they were unsalted, he became irritated and said, I'd rather die than eat such food.
And then you let me know that's how important I was to you.
That's right. We'll get to that in a minute. That's a little foretaste.
Yeah, I want our listeners to know that Josh's oldest daughter demanded that we talk about a fairy tale that we are definitely not talking about on the show tonight, which is The Strange Feast, about the blood sausage that tried to kill the Liververst.
That's right.
So and what was our answer, Josh? We didn't understand it at all.
That's right. We needed Victoria to rescue us, and she knew more than we did. So
something to do with like 18th century German politics or something. Maybe the least satisfying answer she could have given your daughter, I think.
Maybe. But yeah. So all you super fans, sorry, you missed a secret live show. So just I don't know what you want to do with that information. It was not recorded.
No, it was not.
All right. And it was not satisfying. You really didn't miss anything. So, all right, Michael, we got 10 new stories to do, so we should jump into them because we don't want this to go super long. But, and I picked all the long ones.
That's not true. One of mine is long.
Okay. And one of mine is short. So there we go.
So five long ones, five short ones. Let's get started with Puss in Boots, a story that is no doubt familiar to many of our readers. So there's a miller and he has three sons and he dies and he leaves each of them an inheritance. So the oldest son gets the mill, the second son gets his donkey, and the third son gets a cat. And the third son is particularly annoyed by this because he feels like the only thing he could possibly do with the cat is kill him, skin him, and turn his fur into gloves. And the cat, before he can do this, tells him that he wouldn't make a very good pair of gloves. And what he should do instead is bring the cat a pair of boots. And then he does that, and the cat puts on the boots and walks out of the door on two legs like a human being. And he quickly goes to work improving the lot of the miller's son. So there's a king who rules over this entire land, and everybody is kind of walking on eggshells, because the king loves to eat partridge, and for whatever reason, nobody has been able to catch any partridge. But you know who can catch the partridge really well is Puss in Boots. And so Puss in Boots shows up at the king's palace, and he gives him a bunch of partridges and says that he comes from a count. And I lost the line. He uttered a long, distinguished name. And the king thanks him for the partridges and gives him a bunch of money, which means that the miller's son has already made his money back that he spent on the cat's boots. So the next day, Puss in Boots goes out again and brings the king a bunch of partridges and brings gold back to the miller's son. And this goes on for long enough that the king becomes very, very fond of the cat. And the cat just kind of spends all day sleeping in the king's court, and he overhears a bunch of stuff. So one day he hears a coachman say, "May the devil take the king and princess. I wanted to go to the tavern, have a drink, and play some cards, but now they want me to drive them to the lake so they can go for a walk. And the cat, you know, his mind is always turning, as cats' minds always are. And he figures out a way to get the miller to get a noble title that he's already always wanted. So the miller goes with him to the lake, and he goes swimming without any clothes on, and the cat takes his clothes and carries them away and hides them. And then the cat goes to the king and says that his master is this count, and that while the master was swimming in the lake, a thief came and stole his clothes. And so the king gives him some fancy royal garments. And you know, the king is aware that this is the guy who has given him the partridges. And so this allows the miller's son to kind of get in with the royal family. So they're riding together, and the cat runs ahead of them, and he comes across a big meadow where people are making hay, and then he comes across a big wheat field where people are reaping, and then he comes across a giant forest where people are cutting down oak trees and turning them into wood. And at each point, the cat asks them who owns this area, and they always say the same thing, which is the sorcerer. And the cat says, "Well, if you know what's good for you, when the king comes by and asks who owns this, you're going to say the count." And I guess the people are so impressed that he's a talking cat who walks on two legs like a person that they agree to do that. And then lo and behold, Puss in Boots runs across that sorcerer himself, and the cat pretends to be afraid of him and says, "Hey, could you turn yourself into like an elephant?" And yeah, sure. The sorcerer says and turns himself into an elephant. And then he says, "Can you turn yourself into a lion?" And he turns himself into a lion. And then the cat says, "Can you turn yourself into a mouse?" And the sorcerer is like, "Yeah, of course I can." And he turns himself into a mouse, at which point Puss in Boots eats him. And meanwhile, the king and the miller's son are driving by, and the king is very impressed to learn that the miller's son supposedly owns all of these properties. And by the time they get to the castle where the sorcerer had lived, the king has made the miller's son his daughter's fiance and his heir. And when the king dies, the miller becomes king, and the Puss in Boots is his prime minister. And that's Puss in Boots.
That's a real nice story, Michael, but I don't know if I would trade my catskin gloves.
I think he came out on top.
Yeah, I think so. That's a wild story.
You know, one thing that's really good about it is it doesn't drop a lot of stuff. I mean, this is a much more straightforward story than a lot of the ones we've read. It doesn't feel like it has a bunch of accretions on top of the mm-hmm. original story, like we've talked about so many other stories did. Puss in Boots is obviously a trickster. We've talked a lot about trickster characters, but here he's this very good-natured trickster who's working on behalf of somebody else. So there's a sense in which the story suggests a hierarchy and also undermines the hierarchy, because this miller gets turned into a count basically just on the strength of the cat's lies. Mm-hmm. And yet, like, there's something very warm about the story.
Yeah.
Unless you happen to be a sorcerer.
Yeah, I guess so. Sorcerers are never good in these stories, you know. But yeah, it's interesting because it is all built completely on lies. But it's like, I don't know. There's like a sense in which, like, because the story works so well, like, I don't know if this is, like you said, it's like an undermining of the hierarchy, because it's almost like it's the person behind the clothes that actually makes the difference, not the person in the clothes. And so, like, you don't get the impression that the miller is like out of place once he gets the nice clothes to be a count, you know, and once he has the nice fields and stuff. Like, he could have been that anyway. He just, you know, he happened not to be, but now that he has it, it's fine. Or something right. Like that. You know what I mean? Like, people are people in some sort of way in the story, but the social class the indicators of social class matter too much to see past them or something.
One thing I thought was interesting is that the story begins by calling him the Miller's son and then the Miller, but about halfway through the story, it does start calling him the Count. It's like Puss in Boots has convinced the narrator also this Miller's son is actually a Count. He actually makes it true in the world of the story.
Yeah. I always did wonder though, like, what if the carriage driver decided to go a different way? Like, what was Puss in Boots like plan? You know, like, if, like, when he, I mean, yeah, I don't know. He can't dwell too much on it. It's a fairy tale. It works out perfectly.
Well, this one's more coherent than a lot of them. I mean, you know, compare this to The Strange Feast.
Yeah, sure. But I just mean that, like, you know, it just seems like the cat's risking a lot by running ahead and telling these people, like, oh, you know, say it belongs to the count before he's actually taking care of the sorcerer. But I guess he knew already that he'd be able to handle the sorcerer, because why wouldn't he? He's been able to handle everything else. So.
Well, and think about all the other trickster characters we've seen in the other stories. They're always able to handle whatever comes to them. They don't worry.
That's right.
They're light figures. It's the whole Errol Flynn thing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know, it's Robin Hood.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So yeah, just start weaving your lie and follow it to the end, and it'll be fine. Everything will work.
A lie is not a lie if people believe it.
That's right. You could be a prime minister.
Well, from cats to mice.
From cats to mice. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Well, there was once a king. He had three daughters. And as fathers and kings generally do, he wanted to know which daughter loved him the most and the best. And so he summoned them and asked them to tell them how much they loved him. And the oldest daughter said, oh, I love you more than the whole kingdom. And the second said, oh, I love you more than all the jewels and the pearls in the world. And then the third daughter said that she loved him more than salt. And the king got really mad at this pronouncement that he was only as loved as salt and was compared to such a meager, small thing. And so he sent her to be killed in the woods by a woodsman. The woodsman, of course, was never going to do it because he was, you know, he was kind-hearted, good guy. But she asked him to please wrap her in a mouse skin and sent her away. So he did that, and she runs into a neighboring king, and she pretends to be a man and asks for employment. And the king employs her, and whenever she pulls off his boots, he always tosses them at her head. And one day he asked her where she comes from, and she said, from the country where one doesn't toss boots at people's heads. And this made the king very suspicious. Well, anyway, one day, Mouseskin lost a ring, and the other servants found it and brought it to the king. And so now the king is even more suspicious and thinks that Mouseskin must have stolen this ring. But she reveals herself to be a princess. She takes off the Mouseskin, and she's beautiful. And so he wants to marry her, and they have a wedding, and they invite her father, unknowingly invite. He doesn't know that it's his daughter being married. He thinks his daughter's been long dead. And when the wedding feast is served, they serve it without any salt. And the king, the father king, is super irritated about this. He says, I'd rather die than eat such food. And as soon as he says that, she says, well, now you say you can't live without salt. But when I said I loved you more than salt, you wanted to have me killed. And so then he recognizes his daughter and his folly, and begs forgiveness, and then they find each other and love one another again. It's wonderful.
It's a happy ending.
It's a happy ending.
This is a variation on King Lear. Have you read King Lear, Shakespeare's King Lear?
I don't know if I've read that one. I have read some Shakespeare, but I don't know if I've read King Lear.
So King Lear is getting ready
to... I've read the Huckleberry Finn version. Don't they perform King Lear?
I think they do. The King and the Duke do King Lear.
Yes. So I've read that version.
But Lear is about to take the unprecedented step of retiring, and he is going to divide his land up among his three daughters, and he is going to give them land based on how much they love him. So the two wicked daughters are really flattering and exaggerating about how much they love him. And his third daughter's favorite, Cordelia, tells him that she loves him according to her measure. That, you know, she's going to have a husband one day. She can't love her father more than anything. That doesn't make any sense. And he's so outraged that he disinherits her. Mm. And over the course of the play, you know, his other two daughters turn out to be pretty terrible. They, you know, the other two daughters in this just disappear. And at the end, he and Cordelia end up reconciling just before she dies. And it ends up being a tragedy. They actually both die. She is killed and he dies of grief. This is so Princess Mousekin in its weird way is like a King Lear with a happy ending.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And I, if we had an actual folklorist here to ask, I'd be very interested in knowing if Princess Mousekin has some connection to the Lear story, because Shakespeare doesn't invent that story. I think it's from Holinshed, Holinshed's Chronicles. I think that's where it's from. But I don't know. I haven't read the original version either. I just know the Shakespeare version.
Yeah. It's your favorite of Shakespeare?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love King Lear.
I'm going to have to read it. According to Zipes, I don't know if you have your copy in front of you, Michael. On page 744, there's like the end notes. And Princess Mousekin was admitted due to its French origins, and it compares it to something which I'm not going to try and pronounce on air, but maybe you will, from 1697, which would be post Shakespeare. So,
let's see. Peau d'âne, skin of an ass, like a donkey, in Contes de temps passé, tales from times past. I'm sure eventually we'll do Perrault. He's the French. He's not the French version of the Grimm's because he's not collecting stories, I believe. I think he's writing a lot of them. Mm-hmm. But like he's the French fairy tale guy as they are the German fairy tale guys. So I'm sure eventually we'll do Charles Perrault.
Yeah, it'd be fun. And all these stories have, you know, some similarity, you know, somewhere. So, but that is really interesting. I didn't make the Prince Lear connection. I was just thinking, I mean, we've beat to death on this show, so we don't need to go into it. But the idea of like the importance of little things and small things. So that's obviously comes out in this story as well.
Yeah, I really like the kind of homeliness of the end of this story that he has flown off the handle because she compares him to something that everybody uses every single day. Mm-hmm. And he can't recognize what value really is.
Right.
Just like he clearly can't recognize which of his daughters actually loves him the most.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, it's just worth pointing out, asking people to prove that they love you is a horrible thing to do.
Yeah,
people to compete about it is really horrible. And you're lucky if all that happens is you don't talk to your daughter for 5 years.
Yeah, it doesn't usually go well. But there are many stories with that as a premise, so it must be a thing.
Do you ever do that to your four daughters, Josh?
Every day, Michael.
Figure out which one of them loves you the most, right, and reward them based on that.
Yes, that's right.
You're just asking for people to lie to you. It must happen, right? Like, isn't it just obsession, kind of King Lear-ish? Isn't it? Isn't it supposed to be something like that?
I honestly don't know anything about it, but maybe. Yeah.
This is another one where pieces aren't dropped. I mean, I guess the other two daughters are dropped, but in a lot of these stories, once she got sent away from her father, like, we would just never hear about him again. But this one has that nice tie back where everything kind of comes together.
Yeah. We're kind of in the section. We're at the end of the book here, and it's like the I forget. Like, they're all tales that were either, like, left out at some point, like the omitted tales, I think what they're called. And I think a lot of them were omitted because they were based on some other more literary precedent.
Which would make it less shaggy.
Yeah, yeah.
So. Or, I mean, if our list, I don't know how many of our listeners are reading the entire thing with us. I don't know that I would recommend it. but a lot of these are just versions of stories we've already read. So mm-hmm. There's actually another version in here of a story we did very early on, The Boy Who Went Out in Search of What Fear Was.
Mm-hmm.
One who wanted to learn what it was to have the creeps. There's a I think a less funny version of that story in here, and Bluebeard is in here, even though there's versions of the Bluebeard story elsewhere. So yeah, right. we are at the kind of butt ends of the Grimms.
Yeah, I think they made the right choices on all the ones where it's like pulled out because there's a similar story. I feel like the similar story that ended up in the like the Grimms proper tales is the better one. So I feel like they made the right editorial choices there.
Good job, Jakob and Will.
Yeah, that's right. All right, well, I'm done with this one, but I don't want to slip by without saying you are the salt of the earth also. So
Oh, sure.
Ought to be in there.
it's appealing to the same thing, right? That food is just basically inedible without salt.
That's right.
You mean like saltless mashed potatoes?
Oh, man.
Why would you do it, you know? All right, our next story is 227, The Blacksmith and the Devil. So we've got a blacksmith who lives kind of a dissolute life. He throws his money around and drinks a lot. He gets sued a lot and he runs out of money. And so he decides he's going to go out into the forest and kill himself. And just as he's about to hang himself in the forest, a guy with a long beard comes out from behind a tree and he's got a big book in his hand. And he says, "Hey, look, if you write your name in this book, I'll let you have a really good life for 10 years. But then after that, I own you." And the blacksmith asks the right question, which is, "Who are you?" And the guy tells the truth, which is, "I'm the devil." And then instead of saying, "No, thank you, I would like to not go to hell for the rest of eternity," the blacksmith asks the devil to prove that he is, in fact, the devil. And so the devil makes himself as big as a fir tree and then as small as the mouse. And so the blacksmith decides, "Sure, I'll sign your book." And he does. And he has unlimited money for 10 years and he lives a very exciting lifestyle. But then the 10 years are up. I missed a part. The devil comes by about halfway through and gives him a leather sack that if anybody gets into it, he can't get out again until the blacksmith gives him permission. And it says the blacksmith had a great deal of fun with it. And I would love to know what he's doing with that leather sack. But anyway, after 10 years, the devil comes back and says, "All right, you're coming to hell with me now." And the blacksmith takes his sack and goes with them. And they go back to the part of the forest where the blacksmith had almost killed himself. And he says to the devil once again, "I need you to prove that you actually are the devil. You could just be another guy and you're trying to take advantage of me." So once again, the devil makes himself as big as a fir tree and then he makes himself as small as a mouse. And at that very moment, the blacksmith grabs him and throws him in the sack and just starts beating the ever-living crap out of him with a stick. And the devil can't do anything. He can't get out because, you know, the rules of the sack are that if you've been thrown in there, you're not going to be able to get out until the blacksmith releases you. So finally, the blacksmith says, "Okay, I'll let you out of the sack, but you have to erase my name from your book." And the devil doesn't want to do that, but he has to because he doesn't really have another option. So the blacksmith goes back to his old life and he lives for a good long while. And then he's about to die. And when he realizes he's about to die, he has two long nails and a hammer put in his coffin. And after he dies, he goes to Heaven's Gate and knocks. But St. Peter won't let him in because, of course, the blacksmith has been friends with the devil for a long time. So he tries to send him to hell, but the devil's not going to let him into hell because it says he would only make a spectacle of himself. So the blacksmith is mad and starts to make a lot of noise, and a demon comes out from the gates of hell and looks, and the blacksmith grabs him by the nose and nails him by the nose to the gates of hell. And the demon starts screaming, and another demon comes out, and this time the blacksmith grabs him by the ear and nails him to the gates, and they're both screaming so much that the devil himself has to come out. And when he sees his little friends, I'm not sure what the devil's relationship with these demons are, he gets so angry that he goes up to heaven and tells God that he has to let the blacksmith into heaven because the devil can't deal with him doing all this stuff. And either the blacksmith goes to heaven or the devil goes to heaven. And so St. Peter lets the blacksmith into heaven. Although for all we know, those two demons are still nailed to the gates of hell.
I like that detail at the end. Like, either you let me in or you let him in.
and they would prefer, I guess they would prefer still the blacksmith, as unpleasant as he is, to the devil himself. Even though the devil just seems like kind of a doofus in the story. He's not very scary.
He's a total doofus because, I mean, in all the other stories that we've read where people have killed themselves, that means that they belong to the devil, right? Like,
that's true. Why not just let him do?
And so, like, he's already got his head through the noose and the devil stops him. It's like, wait a second, he was already yours, I think. I don't know.
Maybe the rules in this story aren't the same as the rules in the other stories.
Yes, it must be. It must be.
But we have like the ultimate trickster here, right? Like, this is a guy who tricks not just the devil, he also tricks God. And he wins. Like, he gets to go to heaven. I assume he lives in a bad neighborhood in heaven, though. I can't imagine they're letting him in into the nice part. But who knows? I mean, maybe he'll figure out a way. Maybe he'll figure out a way in there, too.
Well, he hangs out with the other guy, because there was another guy who, hopped into the sack, and then that was how he got into heaven. I can't remember what story that was that we read, but some poor soldier had a sack that once you were in, you couldn't get out of, and Saint Peter wasn't going to let him into heaven, so he gave him the sack, and then he wished himself into the sack and got in that way.
That's right. I don't remember the name of that one.
So those two are together.
Oftentimes, especially the long stories, are named after some very minor piece of the story.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, this one reminded me a little bit of, did you ever hear that silly song when you were a kid, the found a peanut,
chicken? Yeah,
and then, you know, goes to heaven, then goes the other way, neither way wants him, and
so
didn't want me.
Yeah, that song used to freak me out.
This one has that interesting detail too about, you know, bury me with these spikes and a hammer, and then somehow, yeah, I guess the things that you're buried with, you get in the afterlife, you know. So he has those available to him to nail the demons to the wall, so, or the gate.
He really thinks ahead for someone who completely squanders all his money.
Yeah,
like you can't accuse him of not thinking about the future.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's related to the Puss in Boots thing too, with the becoming big and then becoming small, and then tricking the person into becoming small and then capturing them that way. So
I do feel like the lesson we're getting today is, if you're able to turn yourself large and small, maybe don't turn yourself small. Although it always seems to work out okay for Ant-Man.
That's right. It does work out for Ant-Man. I didn't make that connection before.
What we need is a Marvel villain whose power is that if he puts you into his sack, you can't get out of it until he lets you out.
That's right.
That would be Ant-Man's, like, ultimate foe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sounds like a lot of fun. Hey, get in the sack. Okay.
Have you ever stepped into a bag like that? Like, I just feel like... And I do love that the story elides that completely. Just, he had a lot of fun with it.
Sack races, you know, and then...
So he tricks people into competing in the sack race.
Yes, but one of the people gets the sack that they cannot get out of. And
he makes them pay to get out, I assume.
Yeah. They all have a good time.
All right. I have the next one too, right?
Yes, you do.
I think I have the next three or four.
Just the next two. You just have the next two.
The soldier and the carpenter. So two boys grow up together. They're both sons of carpenters. And they're when they're young, they're called Little Knife and Little Fork, because they're always next to each other, just like knife and fork are always next to each other on the table. So one of them is very courageous and the other is very cowardly. And the one who's courageous becomes a soldier and the other one becomes a carpenter. And eventually it becomes time for the carpenter to go out as a journeyman carpenter. And the soldier doesn't want to be left alone, and so they go out together. So they get to a city. And the carpenter becomes a carpenter's apprentice. He goes to work for a master carpenter. And the soldier becomes a servant in that same house. But the soldier, as brave as he might be, he is not particularly diligent, and he just kind of lies around, and eventually, you know, that's not going to work for a servant. So the master kicks him out, and the carpenter, you know, out of solidarity with his friend, decides to leave as well. And this just keeps happening. They go from place to place. The soldier is very brave, but he's very lazy and he can't keep a job. And when he gets kicked out, the carpenter also goes. They end up at the edge of a very big forest, and the carpenter, who, remember, is not courageous, says, "I'm not going to go in there. There's probably all sorts of evil spirits in there." And the soldier says, "Look, I'm not afraid. You should come in with me." And the soldier goes ahead, and the carpenter doesn't want to be alone, and so he goes ahead as well. And of course, they get lost in this forest, and finally they find their way to a beautiful, brightly lit castle. And out in front of the castle, there's a black dog, and there's a pond that has a red swan swimming on it. They go into the castle, and there's nobody there until they go into the kitchen, where there's a gray cat who is actually cooking in the kitchen. Josh, do your cats ever cook for you?
Yeah, regularly, Michael. They're on dinner duty at least twice a week.
Well, if they don't want to be turned into gloves, that's their only option. They keep going through the castle, and there's a lot of empty rooms, but there is one room that has a giant table, and it's covered with food and drink, and they're both very hungry, and so they eat a very nice meal, and the soldier says, "Well, I think it's time we go to bed." And so they go into a room, and there's two beds there, and they lie down. And they're about to fall asleep. And then the carpenter realizes, oh, we haven't said our prayers yet. So they look up and they open a cupboard on the wall. And inside there's a crucifix and two prayer books. And so he wakes the soldier up and they kneel down and say their prayers and then immediately fall asleep. But the next morning, the soldier wakes up because somebody has hit him. And the carpenter says he didn't hit him. And in fact, he thinks the soldier hit him. And the soldier says, it's probably a signal that we should get up. I think it would be a signal that you should get out of that castle. But anyway, they go downstairs and the table is set for breakfast. And the carpenter says, before we eat, let's go see if there's anybody else in this castle. And the soldier says he doesn't really want to eat the food because the cat prepared it. And that sounds gross to him. So they can't find anybody anywhere else in the castle. And finally, the soldier says, let's go down into the basement. And when they go down the stairs, there's an old lady there, and they start talking to her. And they say, hey, did you cook that meal for us? And she says, yes. And then they keep going down, and there's a young boy, like a 14-year-old boy there. And they try to talk to him, but he doesn't answer. And then they go down another level, and there's a 12-year-old girl there, and she also doesn't answer. And they go all the way through all the cellars, but there's nobody else there. And when they come back up, the girl is there again, and they ask her if she wants to come upstairs with them. And she says, hey, is the red swan still up there? And they say, yeah. And she says, well, I can't come. And they go to the boy, and he says, is the black dog still out there? And they say, yeah. And he says, well, I can't come with you. And then they get to the old lady, and she says, is the gray cat still in the kitchen? And they say, yeah. And she says, well, here's the thing. If you want us to be able to leave the cellar, you're going to have to kill the swan and the dog and the cat. Well, they go upstairs and they go into the kitchen and they go over to pet the cat, but she has kind of crazy eyes, and it makes them nervous, I assume, especially the carpenter, who's already kind of nervous. And then they go to the one room they haven't found yet, and in it, or they hadn't gone in yet, and they find a bow and arrow, a sword, and iron tongs. And on the bow and arrow are written, this will kill the red swan. The sword says, this will chop off the black dog's head. And the tongs say, this will pinch off the gray cat's head, which seems much more gruesome and violent than the other two, just being honest. Well, the carpenter doesn't want to do it. He wants to get out of there. And the soldier, who's, you know, again, very brave, says, no, let's do it. That way we can get the people out of the cellar. So they're going to do it. And the carpenter says, well, there's only two of us and there's three of them. I really wish there were three of us. And just as he says that, a dove flies into the window and it turns into a handsome young man. And he says that he'll help them. And the young man picks up the bow and arrow, but the carpenter makes him use the sword instead of the bow and arrow, because the carpenter doesn't want to have to get close enough to any of these animals to kill them. So the carpenter shoots the red swan with the bow and arrow, and the the young man kills the dog with the sword, and the soldier uses the tongs to cut off the gray cat's head. And as soon as the three animals are dead, the old lady and the two kids come out of the cellar and yell, "You've killed my dearest friends. You're traitors." And then they attack the people, and they kill them with their weapons. And now there's three bodies that the carpenter's like, "Hey, we should probably bury them. We know they're Christians because there was a crucifix in that bedroom." So they do it. They give them a Christian burial. They go out into the courtyard, dig the graves, say the prayers. But as they're doing, they hear this murmuring from inside the castle that gets louder and louder and louder. And all of a sudden they hear actual voices, and they want to know who it is. And so the young man has disappeared, and it's just the soldier and the carpenter again. And the soldier says, "Let's go back in there." And the carpenter says, "Of course, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm afraid of all this." But the soldier kind of makes him go back in with him. And when they get back in there, all sorts of stuff is going on. Horses are running through the courtyard. Servants are running back and forth. They pretend that this is the first time they've been there, and they ask for something to eat. And somebody says, "Sure, come on in." And they go into this beautiful room, and they're given food and drink. And afterwards, they ask them if they saw two young men come out of the castle, and they lie and say they hadn't. Obviously, it's talking about them. But then somebody sees that there's blood all over their hands, and the soldier says he cut his finger, but they don't really believe him. And finally, the servant goes and tells his master, and it turns out that the master is that young man. And he comes out and says that they have saved the castle and they needed to be celebrated. And so what happens is, that old lady and the two children, she was a witch, and she had worked for the castle, but she got in trouble. And when they scolded her for it, they turned every living thing in the castle into stone. And the three animals were servants that she wasn't able to kill because they had magical powers. So she just turned them into animals. And because she was afraid of them, she went into the cellar with her kids and couldn't come up. So once they kill the animals, she wanted to kill them, but I suppose because they prayed the night before, God wouldn't allow her to kill them. And now the castle isn't haunted anymore, and the Wicked Witch and her children are dead, and everybody who was turned to stone became alive again, and they all lived happily ever after.
Yeah, this story, I feel like it falls apart a little bit at the end.
A little bit. I don't understand why she would come out and yell, "You've killed my dearest friends." I guess, yeah. Is this like her excuse for killing them? That's the idea?
I guess. I don't know. But then anyway, it falls apart a little bit also because the three animals were just like servants who were trying to escape the witches. Thing, you know, the witch's spells. Or when they were under her spells, she turned them into animals instead of killing them. I don't know.
She couldn't turn them into stone because they had some magical powers.
Right. So she turns them into animals instead.
Right.
But then by turning them into animals, she also
loses some of her power.
Yeah. Okay.
So she goes and lives in the cellar.
Right.
And for some reason, she and her two children don't live on the same level of the cellar. By the way, there are three levels of the cellar, which is kind of insane. It's a lot of cellar.
That's
it's like
a
parking garage.
Right. But then who put the weapons there? To kill these innocent servants that just were not turned into stone like the others. But yeah, it's just
going to... And why did the...
It falls apart a little bit.
Why did the prince, who comes in as the dove, why does he help them do that?
Yeah, because they would be his servants, right?
Yeah, and he knows they didn't do anything wrong because he's the one who explains it to them. The story's kind of a mess. Now that I think about it,
it's a little bit of a mess. I don't know if I want to say I like it. It's got elements that are good, but I think the best elements in it are we're going to see again in the Winter Rose in a minute. You know, it's got kind of that Beauty and the Beast, like this the.
The
Enchanted Castle, or it's like Sleeping Beauty's that way too, right? The whole castle gets enchanted until she wakes, whatever. So it's got that Enchanted Castle aspect is kind of fun, but it's like whoever was telling the story didn't quite. They needed an editor. That's what they needed.
The thing I really like about the story is the stuff at the beginning about the carpenter and the soldier, though.
Yeah,
like their relationship is interesting because they're so devoted to each other that they're able to kind of make each other do the thing they don't want to do.
Yes. Yeah. The power of friendship is really good in this story.
What's the one about the guys at the gravesite and the devil shows up? The one I liked so much from a couple months ago. That's what this reminded me of.
Right. Yeah.
I think it might just be called The Gravesite.
Yeah. That is a good one too.
Better than this one. I agree. Like this is a weird Shaggy Dog story. It almost seems like some of these, and I guess it's not just this one. Some of them seem like stories you tell when you're a kid. Did you ever try to make up stories when you were a kid?
Right. Yeah.
And the plot just kind of gets away from you.
Yes. Yeah. I think
that's what this one feels like.
Yeah. There's one that we're not doing that was actually written by one of the Grimm like sons when he was like 12 years old or something. And I felt like, yeah, that same sort of thing where it's like, yeah, it's cool that he's trying to attempt to write a fairy tale, but it didn't quite hold together. So yeah, maybe this one was written by a younger child also.
Can you imagine being one of the Grimm's sons and attempting to write a fairy tale?
Well, it makes sense, you know, gotta impress dad.
You would know how Jacob Dylan felt, you know?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So, but it's a fun, yeah, it's a creepy story, you know?
It is, yeah. It's got some atmosphere to it.
Yeah, it's got really, yeah, I agree. The atmosphere is really good. You could see this in, you know, being some sort of spooky suspense film, you know? The people in the cellar and the animals that are just kind of staring at you and the getting hit on your head by mysterious object to wake up. And I mean, even the crucifix and the cupboard and stuff, you know, like that's all just made for TV creepiness.
Well, and the kind of nihilism of the ending where the three animals who have been killed are actually good guys and nobody seems to care about that. I think that would actually work really well in a horror movie.
Yeah. So there you go.
Well, let's move on to the P-test. Which is not what you have to undergo to get a job with the government.
Different kind of pee.
So there's a king who has a son, and the son wants to get married, and he asks his father to find him a wife. But he's a prince, and so he's not allowed to marry anybody other than a princess. And there are no princesses in this area, so he puts out a proclamation all over the land, and a bunch of princesses arrive at the court. But it turns out they're not actually princesses, most of them. They're just regular ladies, and they would like to become a princess, so they want to marry him. But when he asks them for their birth certificate or whatever, when he tries to figure out what their lineage is, they can't tell him, and so he has to kick them out. So the queen tells him, you need to have patience. That this is going to happen, and it'll happen when you're least expecting it, and just keep at it. So one night there's a stormy evening and a beautiful woman starts knocking on the gate of the royal palace, and she's let in and she demands to see the king. And she says that she is the daughter of a mighty king from a distant country, and she has received the proclamation that the king put out, and she has been in love with his son ever since she got this proclamation. Don't ask too many questions about that. And immediately, as soon as she got the proclamation, she fell in love with the son and has come out to marry him. Well, the king is skeptical of this, probably because, you know, he's heard the story several other times from other women, and she doesn't have an escort. She's not wearing royal clothes, and she has excuses for this. She has explanations for this, but the king doesn't really believe them. And so the queen says, look, let's not throw her out. It's pouring down rain. I'll test her. We'll put her up for the night, and in the morning we'll know if she is a princess. So what she does is she underneath a mattress, she puts three peas in a mattress. It's one on top of the mattress, one in the middle of the mattress, and one under. And then she puts six other soft mattresses on top of the mattress. And she leads the woman upstairs and puts her to bed. And the next morning, the woman tells her that she slept terribly because something in the mattress was hurting her back so much. And that's how she knew she was a princess. And she married the king's son that very day. This is a very familiar fairy tale, I know. I know Hans Christian Andersen does a version of it called The Princess and the Pea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the wisdom of the queen mother in this one. I mean, she really comes across like really like better than both her husband and her son. She's really got it together.
She's kind of unflappable, right? Like, yeah. She doesn't just believe anything somebody tells her, but she also doesn't assume she knows the truth until she knows it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this one is nice, too, because there's a little bit of, like, as opposed to the other Princess and the Pea one. So in the Princess and the Pea one, I think, if I remember right, no one knows she's a princess, right?
I don't remember. I haven't read the Andersen story in a long time.
I'm pretty sure even she doesn't know she's a princess. But there's like there's these different tests, including the pea test. And she like she's a servant in the castle, but she just happens to like pass all these tests while they're looking for the real princess. And then it's revealed that she was a princess all along, which is a very fun story. But in this one, like I kind of like the difference of she knows she's a princess, but the others don't, right? And so, I think that idea of like, I don't remember exactly where I was going with that. Sorry, I had the point, I'm sure, but it's lost me. But I kind of like that.
But she's totally forthright about it too, right? Like she doesn't tell any lies about it. What she says is the absolute truth. It's just an unbelievable truth.
Yeah. Thank you. That sparked what I was going to say. There's a dedication in her, right? So like whether it's, you know, whether it makes a ton of sense to be dedicated to a person that you've never met before, I don't know. But like there is some sort of dedication to her where she's like, I'm going to get there. I'm going to get to that guy.
She's on a quest.
Yeah, she's on a quest. That's right. It's the quest aspect of it, which is cool. It's a different take on it than the Princess and the Pea is the quest aspect, which is kind of fun.
And then, you know, this bizarre idea that a royal would be so delicate that she would be able to feel these peas under six mattresses.
That's right. But still also able to, like, weather the journey to him.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I never even thought about that, Josh, that she's so delicate she can't sleep because there are three peas six mattresses down. But she's so hardy that she's able to walk by herself this long distance in the rain and still have the, you know, she still has the moral courage to kind of announce herself to the king when she gets there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved that story when I was a kid. Like a lot of kids do, I guess.
Yeah. That's a good one.
And eventually we'll do Hans Christian Andersen, and maybe we'll look at it again from his perspective.
Yeah.
That'll be interesting once we start doing stories from other countries that are similar stories. It'll be interesting to see the kind of connections we can find between them.
Right. I was thinking about that today. Like there's stuff that we've run into here that makes me wish that I knew it at the time when we were talking about some of the Disney movies. And then I'm sure it'll happen again, right? Like we'll run across something and whatever we're reading, I'll be like, oh, I wish I had understood that at the time that we read Grimm's. But, you know, that's part of the fun of doing this, you know? You can't know it all.
That's right.
At the beginning, so. All right. Any more on the pea test?
Nope.
All right. The next one's called The Robber and His Sons. So once upon a time, there's a notorious robber, and he was, you know, notorious throughout the land as being this great robber. But then he got tired of being a robber and he turned suddenly good. And everybody was happy about that because he wasn't thieving or stuff, but they didn't know why he had turned good. He did. And he had three sons and they grew up and they were ready to go make their way in the world. And he asked them what they wanted to do. And they said, we want to be like you, Dad. We want to be, we want to be notorious robbers and thieves. And he was like, no, you don't want to do that. That's a terrible idea. Like I left that life. But they're like, no, it'll be great. We can go do this. So they leave, they go to this kingdom and they attempt to steal this horse and they get captured. They don't have dads skilled. And so they get captured by the queen. And the queen contacts the robber and says, I have your sons. And he says they're not even worth the penny to pay the ransom because, you know, I told them not to come be thieves and they did anyway. And she said, well, you know, tell me about your greatest adventures and I'll release your children. So I like this idea of, you know, being saved with a story. So he says, okay, I'll tell you a story to save them. So he tells the story of the time that he went to steal from a giant. And all his companions went with him and they thought it was going to be great. But then a whole bunch of giants showed up and they divided all the companions amongst themselves. And he and his nine companions that were still with him went with this particular giant. And the giant was eating them day by day from fattest down to skinniest. And he was the leanest. And so he was the last one. And he says to the giant, you know, I recognize that you have bad eyesight. I can actually heal that. And the giant believes him, and so he makes this terrible concoction in the pot with all this, you know, terrible things in it and dumps it in the giant's eye. But he still can't escape because there's walls everywhere. And so the giant has these sheep, and so he dresses up as a sheep. He finds a ram's skin, and the giant always lets the sheep go out to pasture by running through his legs. So he runs through the giant's legs, but the giant picks him up. Because he's looking for a sheep to eat and he happens to catch the one that the robber's in. The robber is able to get away from him and he finally scrambles out into the pasture, but he has to have the last word. And so he yells back that, you know, I finally got away from you. And the giant says, oh, well, since you've tricked me, have this ring. And he gives the ring to he throws the ring out into the pasture for the robber to take. But the robber doesn't realize it's a magic ring that makes him yell, here I am, here I am, as soon as he puts it on. So he's running around yelling, here I am, here I am. So the giant is able to chase him down and he can't get away because he keeps yelling and revealing himself no matter where he goes. And so finally, gruesomely, he bites his own finger off in order to save his life. He says, that's my first story for my first son. He says, so for his second story, after this adventure with the giant, he's traveling and he is traveling for days. He's starving. He's in the woods, can't find anywhere to go. And he finally comes across a little small settlement. There's three thieves hanging on the gallows and there's a woman and her son. And he says, is there a village nearby or is there anything? And she says, no, I'm actually days away from my own village. I was kidnapped by this monster who's brought me here. And the monsters have said that I need to cook my own son for them. And they're going to come back this evening and they're gonna make me feed my own son to them. And the robber feels bad for her and for the son. And so he hides the son and he goes and he takes one of the thieves that was hanging on the gallows and he takes him down and he cooks him up so that she can feed him to the monsters. So the monsters come back, but the monster is suspicious and says, I don't know. I don't think you've actually fed me your son. I think you fed me one of those thieves that were hanging out there. And he sends his monster people out there to go check and make sure that there's still three hanging out there. So the robber himself runs out there and is hanging on the he's holding on so that the monster can count that there's still three there. And he actually he wants them to bring a bit of each of the flesh of all three back. And so he hangs himself from the tree and he allows the monster henchmen to come and actually cut a piece of his thigh out. And he doesn't scream out or anything and bring it back to the monsters. So that's his second story. And then, of course, for the third story, we want to know what happened next, right? So for his third son, he tells the rest of that story. And the monster tastes the flesh of the robber and says, oh, that the middle guy on the gallows, his flesh is still pretty fresh. So bring him here. I want to eat him as well. And so they bring the guy in and he is, they drag him in and they've got him stretched out on the floor. And then all of a sudden there's a terrible storm that breaks out and it frightens all the monsters away. And so he's able to bandage his leg and rescue the woman and her son. And they wander for 40 days and they finally come across the woman's village and he gives the woman back to her husband. And the husband is rejoices. And then the queen, who's been listening to all these stories, says, because of your good deeds, you've I'll give you back your sons. You've made up for all the evil that you've done.
What an interesting story.
Yeah. I apparently like the robber stories, because I think I picked the other robber story too a couple months ago.
Yeah, that's true. Well, there's a lot of robber stories.
Yes, but yeah, the Robin Hood esque, you know, the robber turned good, the good hearted robber. They're kind of fun stories. So I
see two literary analogs here. You've got in the first story he tells, it's very very similar to Odysseus and the Cyclops.
Yes, yeah, almost exactly the same. Yes.
Yeah. And then also the whole thing is very Arabian Nights, Scheherazade, mm-hmm. Kind of breaking the story off so she can live another day.
Right. And yeah.
I can't remember when Arabian Nights made it to Western Europe. I think it was the 18th century, so it would have been available to people at the time this story was written down, at least. So I wonder if there's an actual influence there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, why this one was not included. It says, you know, in the back notes, it says it was too close to those other stories, but it's still a fun story. So I like this story has really, really deep self-sacrifice, right? like to allow yourself to like hang there and get your leg cut, you know, in order to try and save somebody without crying out. That's pretty good.
Yeah, except this is also the same guy who at the beginning says it's not worth spending a penny for my son's release.
That's true. That's a good point, Michael. It's true.
So you get this vision of him first as a concerned father and then this kind of very cold man, and it turns out he's capable of a really heroic self-sacrifice.
Yeah, I guess, and he's kind of a mess, I guess.
And he releases the sons not because he tells her a story. She releases a son, the sons because of how heroic he was.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, I assume she would have done it anyway because she agreed to release them for a story, each of them. But she explicitly says that it's not the story; it's what he did in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point, Michael. So, yeah.
I clearly got to read the end notes on these, because you're right. It does specifically mention the Odyssey. And that's the second time that you've pointed out the end notes to me, which I apparently just didn't look at at all.
Well, I you know, honestly, I didn't even realize the end notes existed until this time. So, because we got to the end and then I was like, oh, there's end notes back here but after the end. So I wasn't trying to make myself out as though I, in any sort of way. I happened to cross them and I thought they were interesting. I was like, oh, I wish I would have known about these from the beginning. So, yeah. So, yeah, not much more else to say about that story. I just thought it was a really good story.
It is a good story. And it's another one of those that holds together.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you can kind of see, like, when it's the, I don't know, we've so many of these, it's like that Shaggy Dog story where it's like, oh, yeah, somebody was telling this and this and this and this. But you can kind of tell, like, when it's like you said, like, it's based on the Odyssey. It's like, this has been a story that has been, like, told for time untold, right? Like, I mean, obviously we know, you know what I mean, like, it's just
it's a
foundational story, exactly. Yes, it's a really 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 old story, and so the fact that it's like so old, it's like there's a reason for it, right? There's a reason it survived. You know, because it's a really good story. You want to know how he's gonna get away, and the idea of the ring and having to yell out where you are, and then, yeah, biting your own finger off. It's got a little bit of Frodo and Gollum in it there, you know. So
I would say that detail is actually better than what happens in the Odyssey. Him biting his own finger off, and the fact that he puts the ring on too.
Mm-hmm.
Like I actually like that detail better than the way the Odyssey handles the similar story.
Yeah. Remind our listeners how it is in the Odyssey, because I honestly don't remember that part.
He stops to taunt him, and it's been a long time, but I think it's something like Polyphemus throws a rock and hits the ship. I mean, it's something like that.
Okay, okay. He doesn't throw a ring at him either.
No, he doesn't do that. Okay. It is that he gets held up because he is enjoying taunting him so much.
Right. Yes. I remembered that part, but I didn't remember what happened after that. So, yeah.
So you get that idea that the trickster has almost outsmarted himself.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, my next one, and I think my last one, is The Winter Rose. And this story will, I know, be familiar to everyone. So a merchant has three daughters, and he's about to go on a long journey, and he asks each of them what he can bring back for them. The first one wants a dress. The second one wants a pair of shoes. The third wants a rose. Well, it's winter, and roses don't grow in the winter. And nevertheless, he goes around asking people if they know where he can get a rose, and everybody just makes fun of him. But he has to find a rose because the youngest daughter is his favorite. So he's on his way back, and he comes across a castle, and there's a garden in front of the castle, and half of the garden is in the summer and half of the garden is in the winter. So there's a bunch of snow on one side, and on the other side, everything is in full bloom, and there's a whole like hedge of roses. So the merchant goes in, picks a rose, and goes away, and he hears an animal behind him, and he turns around, and there's a giant beast that says, "Give me my rose back or I'm going to kill you." And the merchant says, "Look, I only picked the rose because my daughter, who's the most beautiful girl in the world, wanted it." And the beast was like, "Okay, you can have the rose, but she has to marry me." And the guy says, "Okay, yeah, that's fine." And he just figures, you know, the beast is not gonna pursue this any further. But in fact, the beast says in a week he's going to come and fetch his bride, which he does. And he brings her back to the castle, and everything there is beautiful. And he's actually very friendly. It's not like in the Walt Disney Beauty and the Beast. He doesn't have to learn how to be a human. He's very friendly. He does everything he can for her. They eat together. He won't eat if she doesn't serve him, which doesn't seem as nice. But she does. She starts to fall in love with him. And she starts to miss her father and sisters. And he takes her to a magic mirror, and she can see that her father is dying of grief for her, and her sisters are crying, and she asks if she can go home, and the beast says, "Yeah, but you have to come back in a week." So she does it, but the father actually dies while she's there. His grief has just been too much, and he can't recover, so he ends up dying, and she falls into mourning and has just completely forgets to go back to the beast. So finally, when she finally remembers, she goes back, and everything there is different. The castle has black crepe everywhere. The summer garden is gone. It's all snow. The beast is gone. She can't find him anywhere. And finally she goes out into the garden, and there's a big pile of rotten cabbage in the garden, and she starts taking them down, and underneath them, the beast is underneath the rotten cabbage, dead, or apparently dead. And she pours some water over him. He jumps up, and he's not a beast anymore. He's a handsome prince. They tear down a black crepe. The summer garden blossoms again, and they lived happily ever after.
That's it's a great story. It's very much like Beauty and the Beast story. That ending, though, wow, they were really workshopping that one.
The cabbage heads, it's such an odd detail. There's no, obviously, you know, with all these, there's almost never an explanation for what has happened.
No,
but like some sort of rule of magic has been violated, and he, but she doesn't have to kiss him. It's so interesting the way that the more familiar version of Beauty and the Beast, which I think is a Charles Perrault, I think the version we all know is a descendant of the Charles Perrault version.
Yeah, I think so.
Which is actually before this. I mean, Perrault writes it down before the Grimms write this down. I don't know how far back the actual story goes. But anyway, the distinction between this and the version we all know, and especially the Disney version, is interesting to me, because there's never this sense. He fetches her by force, it says, and he does make her serve him dinner. But there's no sense in which he is a monster the way he is in all the versions of that story I'm familiar with.
Right.
That he's scary, and she has to learn to see beyond that.
Yeah, he's clearly under some sort of like spell or something, because he turns into a human at the end. But, like, there's no details about, like, why, you know, like, why he's under that spell. Like, did he do something wrong? Did he just come across a, you know, did he make a deal with the devil? Like, whatever, right. You know? Like,
there's none of that. Did an old lady ask him to come in and he wouldn't let her?
Yeah.
Because he's 11 years old or whatever.
Yeah.
I also like the detail that the father, even though she goes back, the father dies of his grief. That, like, there's a sense in which the love story here has consequences. It has weight to it that have negative repercussions that can't be undone.
Yeah.
So we have two deaths, and one of them is undone, but the other one isn't. And, you know, it's the one that I suppose shouldn't be undone, because, you know, she's moving from being her father's daughter to her husband's wife.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of natural progress. So you have that kind of coded, you know, daughter to wife movement.
Right. Yeah. But the cabbages, what's the story with the cabbages? I don't know. I guess they're kind of rose-ish, and like they've got the same sort of, you know, like the way the petals all are on top of each other. I don't know. Something there.
Are they related?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
There's a British fabric brand called Cabbages and Roses.
Oh, okay. Based on the story, I'm sure.
It might be based on the story. You're right about that. I really like the idea of the half the castle is winter and half is summer. So no matter which one you're in the mood for, you can have it.
Oh, yeah. That
appeals
nice.
To me.
Yeah, that is nice. Except that goes away at the end.
No, does it? The summer garden blossomed again.
Oh,
it
yeah.
The winter went away.
Okay, the winter's still there. Yeah, that is nice. So, go get, you know, jump in the pool, get nice and hot, and then run over to the winter side and cool way down. And
make snow angels.
Make snow angels. Oh, yeah. Okay. That's nice.
All right. Are you ready for your next one?
Okay. This one is a Norwegian fairy tale, The Celebration of the Underground Creatures. And it specifically says it's Norwegian. So I assume that is the reason why it was not included. So this is a kind of an Aladdin-ish story where the princess has to choose a prince by a certain day, but she's in love with a servant, and so that can never be. And so they run away together. And so the princess, her name is Aslaug, and the prince is named Orm. And they run away, and they're running from the king, who's trying to get his daughter back. They make it to the ocean. They get on a boat. They're sailing out. They see an island. They keep trying to get to it, but they can't get to it. That's too windy and stormy. But Orm prays, and that allows them to arrive at the island. So they get to this island, and there's a giant stone on the beach, and there's also this like lovely little cottage, and it's all like the food's like ready to eat, like everything's just, you know, it's set up really nice and lovely, and the owner is nowhere to be found, and so they move into this cottage and they live very happily, and Orm goes and fishes in the sea every day, and they have wild bird eggs, and it's just a nice life. And soon Aslaug gives birth to a child. And as soon as she gives birth to a child, this giantess named Guru shows up. She's from the race of old giants. And she says, oh, hello, I couldn't come here before, but now that this little pagan has been born, I can show myself. And you're in my house, and I'm happy that you're here. It's great to have you. Just don't baptize this kid, and don't ever say the name that giants can't hear. And if you would please let me have my house back on the shortest night of the year, or the longest night of the year, rather, sorry, the Yule night, the longest night of the year, because that's the day that all the underground creatures, you know, we celebrate, then you can live here. And in fact, I will make your life great. Everything that you, you know, try to do will be successful. And so they take that deal, and Orm's fishing, you know, he's bringing in more fish than ever, and it's just great. You know, his hunting, he can't miss. It's just everything's good. So then Christmas arrives. They get the hut all ready, and they decide instead of leaving, they're going to hide up in the loft. And so they go up there to hide, and all these dwarves and elves and just, you know, the magical creatures, they all show up, and they're having a great party. They bring all this like splendid gold plates, and you know, the silverware and everything is just, you know, it's magical, wonderful stuff, as you would expect. And then Guru comes, and she hugs the giant stone, and it makes that stone come to life, and they are a giant couple, and they come in and enjoy the party. And after the creatures all eat, they start up a dance, and the music is so like amazing that Aslaug just has to see. You know, her heart is going to burst if she doesn't see. So she peeks down, she's holding the little baby, and she peeks down and she's watching this dance, and it's just lovely. And then the baby sighs, and she looks down at her baby as any mother would, and without even thinking about it, she just says, "May Christ bless you, my child." And when she says those words, there's a sudden scream, and the lights go out, and it's dark, and all the dwarves are trying to scramble out the windows and the doors, and they're running all out of there. And the couple obviously is terrified of what have we done, you know? And so they hide until the next morning. The next morning, they come downstairs, and all the glittering gold stuff has been left. But at the head of the table is that giant stone that was out on the beach before. And Guru shows up again, and she says, I know you didn't do this on purpose, so I forgive you. Just shocking. I don't understand this, but this is amazing. She says, I forgive you. But she says, you've taken all my joy from me. That that stone was my husband, and we were married, and we were driven away by Odin. And so a similar story to Aslaug and Orm. We were driven away, and so we came here to this island, and we were living happily here until Saint Olaf came from Brittany. And when Saint Olaf came, my husband was worried about having a saint around, and so he blew the ocean to keep Saint Olaf away. But Saint Olaf was more powerful, by the power of God, was more powerful. And when he came and saw the giant, he said, "You will stand here as a stone until Judgment Day," and turned him into a stone. But once a year, Guru can give up 100 years of her own life to turn him back into a giant for 7 hours, and now she will never be able to do that again. And so she says, "You can live here, it's fine. I'm going to take my magical instrument, and don't ever try to settle any of the islands around here, because all the dwarves are going to live on them." And she leaves. And so Orm takes all the treasures, sells them. He's able to reconcile with his father-in-law now that he's rich. And years later, a holy man comes, and he finally moves the stone out of the house and back to the beach. And that's the end.
What a strange story this is.
I really, really like this story. I think, you know, my favorite Christmas story is probably A Christmas Carol, especially the Muppet version. But I would love to have a Muppet version of this story. I think that might be my next favorite Christmas movie, if the Muppets would do this story.
This kind of weird, like, end of paganism sadness.
Yeah, I think that's what really appeals to me about it, is it's like this idea of, the pagans are defeated, and the pagan gods are defeated, and they're wandering. They're trying to, like, you know, find their place on the earth now that Christianity's around, and they can't go anywhere where Christians are. And, you know, they can show up when there's a pagan around, but if the Christians are there, if they say Jesus Christ, if they, you know, make the sign of the cross, then, you know, they just have no power over any of that. And
the baby is a pagan because he hasn't been baptized, right? That's the idea.
Yeah, that's the idea, is the baby's a pagan because he hasn't been baptized. And then I like the idea of, like, yeah, it all happens on Christmas, you know, like, it's like the light coming into the darkness. And I mean, it's really, there's so much like rich stuff in here, you know. I really like it.
Yeah. Well, it has so much sympathy for the displaced pagans.
Yeah, it has sympathy for the pagans, and even for their, I mean, I guess symbolically, maybe the gods represent the pagans themselves, or maybe, I mean, so what's interesting, like, I was listening to a podcast, Symbolic World. Do you ever listen to Symbolic World, Michael?
I don't.
The Symbolic World podcast, they were talking about some Irish fairy stories and folk tales and stuff. And I guess in a lot of the Irish fairy stories, like the fairies are these kind of like in between creatures. They're not like demons, but they're not angels, you know, like then they're not people. And so in a lot of them, like the fairies are kind of like, do you think we'll be able to be saved too? You know, and the Christians are always like, well, you got to kind of wait till judgment day, because, you know, that's not told to us, you know, and you kind of get that feeling here with like these guys, you know, like they're kind of like, yeah, we, you know, they're not, I mean, she forgives that, like Guru forgives them. Like, that's just the craziest, wildest part of the story to me.
Yeah.
Guru forgives them. It's kind of like, yeah, well, what's going to happen with us? You know, like what, like these, you know, little g gods and other beings that are like in the world, you know, really in the world in paganism, you know, like what happens to them now that Christianity's come? I don't know. I think it's really fun to think about.
Yeah, and another thing that's interesting is even though the metaphysics of the world have changed, the same story is being told a second time. Right? You have this parallel narrative between a woman who is being driven out by Odin and Aslaug, who's being driven out by her father.
Right.
That,
yes.
Like even though we've changed from paganism to Christianity to that particular interpersonal dynamic, nothing has changed about that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that's interesting.
Yeah, it's a lovely story. It like a lot of these that we've been talking about today feels more written than these other ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this one feels more like it's got some, so the author had some purpose in it, you know. It wasn't just like to entertain or whatever. Like there's other stuff going on or something. So it's fun story.
Yeah.
The next one is not as fun. It's very wild. I think the connection though between the one I'm about to tell and the one I just told is there's like this like connection to the spiritual world that the people who are telling these stories are telling that we don't have in or most of us don't have, I guess, you know. But anyway, I'll tell it and then we can talk about that.
This one really would make a good horror movie.
Yeah, this one's terrifying. Hold on to your seatbelts, everybody. Yeah, okay. So there's a king and he can't have a child. And so he says, I want a child, even if it's the devil. And so lo and behold, his wife gets pregnant and gives birth to a terrible child. It's ugly, black as a raven, it acts like an animal, screams, just this terrible devil child. And at 12 years old, this child asks for a tomb. And so they build her a tomb inside the church behind the altar. And the king assigns 6 soldiers to guard this coffin each night that the girl stays in all day. She comes out at 11 o'clock and she goes back in at midnight. And every day when she comes out at 11 o'clock, she kills all 6 of the soldiers who are guarding the coffin. And so one day the king is out wandering around and he meets a young man. And he says, young man, where are you going? He says, oh, I want to be, you know, a shoemaker or a miller or a tailor or something, you know. And the king says, oh, no, you don't. You want to be a soldier. And in fact, I'll promote you right away. You just have to guard my daughter's coffin for one night. And the guy feels compelled by the fact that the king is doing giving this. I guess he can't say no to the king. And so he goes. But as night is approaching, he's like, I'm getting out of here. And so he leaves and runs into this old man. And the old man's like, where are you going? And the soldier's like, oh, yeah, I just need to take a walk, you know, get a breath of fresh air. And the guy's like, I know you're trying to desert, but here's what you do. You kneel down in front of the altar. You spread your arms. And you don't move all night. And so the guy goes back and he does that. And the girl comes out of the tomb at 11 o'clock, and she grabs a saber, and she's beating him with it and screaming, and the blood's flowing. It's gruesome, but he doesn't move. He remains in prayer in front of the altar, kneeling with his arms spread, and at midnight, she goes back into the coffin, and the next morning, the king is amazed that he has miraculously survived. No one else has survived in 2 years, and this guy has survived, and so then he says, please guard her for a second night. And the guy says, okay, because he's compelled by the king. But again, he tries to leave. Again, the old man sees him. He says, this time you need to lay down and pray in front of the altar. Don't move and don't stop praying no matter what. Same thing happens. She comes out at 11. She's beating him. And he stays in place until the morning. And he's fine. And the king is once again amazed and says, please stay one more night. And the guy's like, she's going to kill me. She's got, you know, there's no way I can survive a third time. So he's like, I'm out of here. But the old man says, listen, this time, you lay down in her coffin as soon as she comes out and don't get out again, no matter what happens, until she's crying. And then when she's crying, you'll be good. And so he does it. It's 11 o'clock comes and the coffin opens. She gets out. He quickly jumps in. He lays down. She's berating him and yelling at him and trying everything to get him out of the coffin. He won't move. And then lo and behold, midnight comes and she's crying and weeping and she says, I won't hurt you anymore, I promise. And he looks and she's turned into a beautiful girl instead of this devil being. And she says, I was cursed by my father. He said, you know, I would have a devil for a child. And so I was cursed to live like this for 14 years and you have saved me. And all the soldiers, all the 2 years of soldiers who had died six a night for 2 years, that's a lot of soldiers, they all come back to life, and it's a big, giant party. They get married. It's amazing. It's beautiful. Beautiful, happy ever after.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is like legitimately a happy ending in the sense that everybody who died, it comes back to life. It's the classic, all I can think of is eudaimonia. It's eucatastrophe.
Yeah.
But
yeah, this is a major eucatastrophe.
my goodness, up to this point, like, this really is a horror movie. I would love to see this one turned into a turned into a like a supernatural horror movie.
Yeah. Whew, I don't know if I could watch it. I can read it. I can tell it. I don't know if I'd be able to watch it on screen.
Yeah, like it is. You know, it says she's so ugly that people were truly frightened when they caught sight of her. I think that would be very difficult to do in a movie.
Yeah.
And then to have any kind of sympathy for her so that when the turn happens at the end, you don't hate her.
Right. Yeah, I feel like we don't have this sort of like idea in our world anymore. And probably rightly so, you know. You know, like the disciples asked Jesus, they're like, who sinned, this guy or his parents, that he was born blind? You know, it's like there's this idea that like your parents' sin could like impact your life, which, you know, in this case is the case. Like she's innocent. It's her dad that wished, like, you know, hey, I'll even take a devil for a child, which we've seen before, right? Like with the Hedgehog and stuff, you know. But even, I mean, in some ways, it's even like Snow White in a very strange way, you know. It's like, oh, I wish I could have a child like this. I'd do anything for it. And then most of the time the mother gets the child but dies in the process, right? It's like, be careful what you wish for, I guess, you know.
You gotta wonder why King Magnifico granted this wish that year. There's so many other ones. And yes. This one destabilizes society.
Yeah. Thank you for pulling that together, Michael. That was really good. Yeah. What I like about our hero in this one is like he's genuinely terrified.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned earlier, like the boy who went to go find the creeps or whatever. And like so many of our stories are that way, you know, where we've got this like ambitious, you know, the brave little tailor or whatever, where they're a trickster and like whatever comes at them, they don't really like, they always have a plan. They're always ready. They don't care. Like they're fine, you know, and those stories are fun. Like I really like the boy who went out to find out what the creeps were. Like it's a really fun story. But this one, like, that's not this at all. Like this guy is terrified. Like he's going to die, you know, but he's faithful and he, you know, he does what's asked of him. He obeys, and in some way, like, it's like, I mean, it's obviously sacrificial, you know, he's getting, you know, bludgeoned with a sword two nights in a row or three nights. I don't know if she's still stabbing him the third night, you know, but like there's some way in which he's filling up the suffering necessary in order for her to be released from this curse. It's kind of cool.
Okay. Did you watch the film version of Gawain and the Green Knight that came out a few years ago?
I did not. I'm aware that it exists, but I did not watch it.
I don't know that I would recommend it. I certainly would not recommend it to your children. But like one of the things that movie got right was the sheer weirdness of the medieval worldview. Like how, you know, if the supernatural really does break into our world, how disorienting it would be for that to happen all the time. Mm-hmm. I would love to see the director of that movie make a film adaptation of this. I would be there on opening night. I would buy my tickets in advance. Because I think the tone of that movie applied to this story would have been just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, that goes back to what I was saying as I kind of previewed the story, is like there is something about the worldview that comes through in these stories that makes them so bizarre for us to read, but like there's a something, I don't know, like slightly appealing about it, you know, because I do believe in the spiritual realm, but like I don't believe in it the way the medievals did.
Right.
And so like as we've said on the show before, you know, like if they were right, like man, we're really living in darkness, in spiritual darkness, you know, like because we're not acknowledging the spiritual realities at all. So yeah, I don't know. It's good. I mean, it's a terrifying story.
Well, the last one is terrifying in a much more prosaic way.
That's right. Okay, we'll get to the last one.
This is, I, you know, and I'm glad this is the last one the last Grimm's we're doing. It is maybe the least typical Grimm's fairy tale we read.
Yeah,
this feels incredibly modern.
Yeah. All right. Before I tell it, I'm just going to say one last thing on the other one was James 4:7 says, submit yourselves, therefore, to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. And I thought that's what that guy's doing. He's resisting the devil three nights in a row. So, OK, King Ironhead. Man, this is a weird one. It's really weird. All right. Although it starts kind of same. King, three daughters. You know, that's to be expected. So here's this king. He's got three daughters. And he wants them to remain pure, as, you know, most fathers do, I guess. And so he gives them three gifts to these beautiful daughters, and it's going to ensure their purity. He gives them a dove, a ruby, and a rosemary bush. And he wants them to show them to him when he returns, because he has to go off to war. Now, meanwhile, they've got a neighbor named King Ironhead, and King Ironhead is in love with loving. Like, he is always pursuing women and chasing them around. And so he really wants to get into the castle where these three innocent girls are, unable to, you know, their dad's not around. And so when the king leaves, he walls up the castle, and there's only a basket that's there that the girls can lower in and out to get their food and stuff. So King Ironhead disguises himself as a peddling woman or a begging woman, and shows up and actually crawls into the basket and says, you know, please let me in. I'm starving. I'm cold, you know, and really appealing to their compassion. Well, the older daughters feel that compassion, but they say, we're not going to do anything unless all three of us agree. So the older daughters go to the youngest daughter, who's the most beautiful, and her name is Marianne. And they say, Marianne, there's this old woman outside. And Marianne says, absolutely not. Do not let her in. You know, we're not supposed to let anybody into the castle. Just throw some food down to her. She'll be fine. But when they go back, the wailing and the moaning is just too much for their hearts. And they drag, unbeknowingly drag King Ironheart or Ironhead into the castle. And so later the girls are all playing a game, and King Ironhead reveals himself that he's there, and he says, well, I want to play this game, and then whoever loses, they have to sleep with me. And so I guess they feel like they're in this position where they have to do it. And so they do it. And Marianne is the one who's going to have to sleep with King Ironhead. And so she says to him, I'm happy to sleep with you, but my bedroom's not ready. Give me a couple hours to go get it ready. And also, we have to sleep on the floor because I don't ever sleep on the bed. And he says, that's fine with me. No problem. And so she goes up to prepare her room. She puts all the furniture and stuff away and reveals in the room there's a sewer grate that runs all the way down into the sewer of the castle. And she puts her blanket over the sewer grate. And then she says, you know, okay, I'm ready. And he comes in and he jumps onto the blanket and goes all down into the filth of the sewer. And fortunately for him, there's somebody down there, one of his servants, where the sewer empties out, and he's able to get him out of the sewer. Well, at this point, King Ironhead is obviously incredibly angry, and he vows revenge on these girls. And so he hires a sorcerer to make the older two daughters pregnant so that they will desire foods that only he has growing on his lands and that they don't have growing on their lands. And so this happens. The two older girls get pregnant, and, you know, pregnant ladies are, I guess, stereotypically, even back at this time when the story was told, known for desiring strange things or whatever. And so the older daughter, or one of the daughters, it doesn't matter which one, she desires the apples that are growing in King Ironhead's orchards. And so Marianne is the one who has to go. Obviously, the other two are pregnant. And she says, oh, man, this is a bad idea. But she sneaks over there. She thinks nobody's around. She's up in the apple tree, and she looks down. And there is King Ironhead. And he was sleeping under the tree. And he had already prepared this trap of a barrel with the nails in it, you know, kind of angled one way so you can crawl in, but then you can't crawl back out, and a cane so that once you're crawled in and all bent over, you can get beat with the cane. It sounds very terrifying. Marianne says, oh, I'm not sure how you want me to crawl in there. Can you demonstrate? And King Ironhead says, yeah, sure. And he demonstrates for her, and then she beats him with the cane and then escapes back to her castle. Meanwhile, King Ironhead had told his, you know, servants, no matter what you hear in here, don't come in, you know, in the garden, because, you know, he was planning on capturing Princess Marianne. So they don't come in to rescue him. And by the time they do get to him, it's just terrible. He's just in a terrible state. So then Marianne gets a ox skin, and she fills it with salt and vinegar, and she disguises herself as a doctor, and she goes to King Ironhead's castle and says, oh, I've heard your king has been terribly wounded. I have this thing that'll heal him in 1 hour. And his servants say, okay. So she brings this skin, and she wraps him in this vinegar and salt and sews it up. And on the inside, she has written, this was done by Marianne, who bedded Ironhead in filth. And so obviously this is terribly torturous for him, and he's screaming, and she tells them, you know, just wait 1 hour or it won't work. And they believe her, and so he's, you know, tortured in this way for an hour. And then they open it up, and it's terrible. This says there's a horror show, and then they see that she has, you know, put her signature in there, that this was done by Marianne. And so then now King Ironhead is this is the second time now that he's going to kill Marianne. First, she stole his apples and got away, and then she did this to him. So now he's twice, I'm going to kill Marianne. But the other sisters are still pregnant. They want some sort of rare food that only King Ironhead has. So she goes over to the kitchen of King Ironhead. She disguises herself as a chambermaid, and she's, you know, she's still super beautiful, and flatters the cook. And the cook says, oh, yeah, I'll give you whatever you want, but just let me just go, you know, make sure it's okay with King Ironhead. So the cook goes to get to make sure it's okay, and leaves Marianne alone in the kitchen. Marianne makes a complete disaster of the kitchen, steals the food that she wants, writes, this was done by Marianne, and hightails it out of there. By the time the king gets back, now all of his food is ruined, and it's, so now he vows for a third time that he is going to kill Marianne. Then the other sister, now she wants a rare wine that only King Ironhead has, and the exact same thing happens. Flatters the keeper of the wine, destroys all of his wine, pulls out all the corks and the bottles and the barrels and stuff, floods the whole winery, steals the wine that she wants, says this was done by Marianne. So fourth time, he's ready to kill her. And then the children are born. And she says, you know, you guys, these aren't actually your kids. You know, the sorcerer did this to you. So we should, they belong to King Ironhead. So she packs the kids up in a couple boxes and gives them some bottles so they'll be quiet. And she disguises herself as a peddler selling medicine and goes over to King Ironhead. And King Ironhead happens to be suffering a headache at this time. And she places her hand on his head and it feels better, because that usually feels better when someone puts their hand on your head. And so he trusts this doctor. And she says, I have the perfect medicine for you, but I don't have it with me. But I'll leave these boxes of all my finest medicines here as proof that I'm coming back. And then she leaves. And so they're waiting around for her to come back with the medicine. And pretty soon the boxes start making crying baby sounds. And they open up the boxes. And what do you know? There's the babies. And it says, once again, this was done by Marianne. And so for the fifth time, he vows to kill her. Well, then the king returns. And the king returns and wants to see the gifts that he gave his daughters. Of course, they can't show them to him because they've become pregnant. And so they reveal everything that's happened to him. And he's disappointed or whatever. And then he goes over to see King Ironhead. And King Ironhead greets him and says, oh, my father, I really want to marry your daughter, Marianne. And the king is incredulous. He says, you really want to marry Marianne? He says, yeah. And he says, okay, you can do that. And goes back and tells Marianne that she's going to marry King Ironhead. And Marianne says, I can't do that. He's vowed to kill me five times, you know? And he says, well, you were smart enough to get out of it all the other times. I'm sure you'll be fine. And so they get married. And then he's ready to kill her. And she says, please give me 3 days. I need to repent of all my sins, especially all my sins that I've done against you. And so he allows her 3 days. And during those 3 days, she fashions a model of herself and she fills it with ox blood. And she puts it on the bed. And so then on the third day, he comes in and he sees her laying on the bed. She's actually hiding under the bed. Her model is on the bed. And he thinks to himself, oh, it really is a shame. She is so beautiful, but she's got to die because she's done all these terrible things to me. And so he takes a sword and he stabs the model and the blood gushes everywhere. And as soon as the blood gushes everywhere, he says, oh my goodness, I can't believe I've done this. I repent. I wish I'd let her live. And then she pops out and says, surprise, I'm alive. And then they live happily ever after.
Wow. So, I mean, first thing to say, you've cleaned up the quote, right?
Yeah, this is a Michael.
Yeah. But it's not just, that's not the only thing that's weird about it, right? Like, you have this very real life sexual predator, basically. Like, this is a guy who is completely organizing his life around his attempt to sexually assault a teenage girl.
Yeah, that part is not great. I will say that.
Well, like, it would be, fine is not the right word. It would be narratively acceptable if they didn't end up together at the end. You know what right. I mean? If they didn't live happily ever after together. Like, yeah. I don't know that I would have a problem with it, because you'd have this kind of monstrous man who gets what he deserves again and again, where this sly teenage girl tricks him and humiliates him. But what's yes. weird about the story is that they end up together at the end. It's what everybody says about the Disney Beauty and the Beast. And when we did that episode, we talked about how that's kind of a silly reaction to that movie. But it's not a silly reaction to this story. Like, this guy is actually a sexual predator, and unaccountably and out of nowhere, she falls in love with him. And,
yes.
And we're clearly supposed to feel like that's a happy ending for her.
Right. It is the unaccountably and out of nowhere part that makes this story difficult and almost made me not pick it. I really liked all the, I mean, I know it's sick to say I like this, but I liked all the revenge parts. Like, I thought,
yeah, well, it's funny
they're
stuff.
They're terrible, right? Like, but it is funny.
It's Home Alone.
It's Home Alone, and it's and her, you know, signing her name on it every time, even in a filthy way, is also funny, you know, like, yeah. So that's the part I liked. I was a little shocked at the end. I would say you have to read way, way, way between the lines. Probably that doesn't actually exist to find any sort of, like, why would there be redemption for both of them to come together in the end? It is wildly out of unexpected. If this was a modern telling, like if you were to try to clean this up and retell it, then there would be some way in which he being humbled over and over and over would actually be leading to some sort of humility in him and some sort of, like, some sort of, like, begrudging, like, actually, like, respect for her and the way she's able to.
Where he would need to repent for what he had done.
Right.
Working at the battered women's shelter for 6 months.
Yes. Yeah. Something would need to happen. Right. And that does not happen in the story. Like I said, if you want to imagine it into there, you'd have to really, really, really read between the lines.
Now, you told me last night that you told this story to your daughters as a friends to lover or an enemies to lover story.
So I sort of did. It was not quite to this level because it's hard to tell, you know, with there's certain details that, you know, I don't really want to, I don't want to bring in the sexual predator part to my kids.
Right.
So it was just kind of a, you know, this guy wanted to marry her and she didn't want to marry him and, you know, that sort of thing. But yeah, my wife was still very upset because she did not think this doesn't qualify as enemies to lovers. That the genre of enemies to lovers, you see the reasons why they are enemies and you start to see their heart and then it comes together, you know, which people who are interested in that genre. It's a thing. It's a thing that exists in the world, you know?
So. I mean, is it wildly different from Taming of the Shrew, to talk about Shakespeare again, where you've got a guy who's, he's not a sexual predator exactly, but he is abusive and it's played for laughs. And at the end, you know, she does actually fall in love with him. Spoiler alert for the Taming of the Shrew.
Yeah. I mean, I think that you're right. Like, and I think there's definitely different, sensibilities, if you want to say that, you know, like people were looking for different things in their stories at that time, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just like the values have changed, but boy, it's a difficult one. It's fun for a long time. It really is just that ending. I really, you could pitch it as black comedy for the rest of it, that this is an evil man who wants to do something evil to this teenage girl, and she consistently outsmarts him and humiliates him. Like, that's awesome.
Yes.
It's just the last two paragraphs come in and it's what on earth is going on here?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. It's, it's those last two paragraphs that really, like, yeah, it's not great. not a great look, but, you know, I don't know. It's, That's kind of why I wanted to talk about it, I guess. You know?
Yeah. In its way, it's the opposite of one of the other King stories, which I think remains my favorite of the Grimms that we read, King Thrushbeard, where there you have this very haughty princess who torments poor King Thrushbeard, and it turns out he loved her the whole time, and she ends up being humbled by it, and it's his love for her that changes her and allows her to be worthy of his love for her. This seems like almost the exact opposite of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good thing to bring in as a, you know, a comparison, because I do wonder if we're supposed to see in his being humiliated over and over and over that he has learned some sort of humility the way the princess does in that one. You know, it doesn't seem like it because he's still willing to kill her. But then it's like, what, like, you know, he's. I'm not trying to make a defense of King Ironhead. I think even then the name, like, I'm wondering if he's kind of supposed to be an idiot. Like, is Ironhead like some sort of like blockhead? So again, I'm not trying to make a defense of it. I'm just trying.
And yet you want to call it Ironheart, right? Like you've done it a couple times. I've almost done it a couple times. Like, cause that's where he seems to be so cruel.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, other than the crawling into his own barrel, that seemed really dumb. Like, who would do that, you know? Like, oh yeah, I've set up this trap for you, let me show you how it works. Like, what was the plan there? But yeah, the rest of it, he seems cruel. Yeah, although, you know, it's one of those things, again, I'm not making a defense for King Ironhead, just to be clear, but like the way the elements in these fairy tales, like the beginning elements, get dropped so often, and so for us, like, there's no way that we can drop the sexual predator nature of it.
That's correct.
But, and maybe they could, you know, maybe the people who are telling it could, because so many, like, it's just normal for things at the beginning of the story to get dropped because you're just working towards the end of the story. And by the end of the story, he does, you know, like, I mean, he wants to kill her. He wants revenge on her, but she's the one doing all the evil, if you want to call it that, to him, you know, like he's, you know, Once you get past the barrel, you know, like, he's not setting traps for her beyond, you know, there, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I mean,
he's already knocked down the domino of setting the trap by making the other two sisters pregnant so that they desire the things he has. So I guess in that sense, like, he's already like he hasn't gone back to the sorcerer and like magically made them not pregnant or something. So I don't know.
I wonder if the original audience of this story would have seen King Ironhead not as a sexual predator, but as a kind of lovable rake.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's just so impossible for me to see him that way. He's so horrifying.
Yeah.
He, in terms of grim villains, he's up there with the witch from the juniper tree.
Oh yeah. And that's very bad. Yeah.
Right. Like it's that, what he's trying to do is that evil, to get these two girls pregnant, which I guess he does through magical means, and it's not a euphemism for him, you know, physically impregnating them, but to get them pregnant so he can lure their sister into his garden and rape her. Like it really is disturbing.
Yeah.
Which is what makes the middle part of the story where she just keeps hitting him in the head with a paint can so much fun.
Yeah.
But it would be like if at the end of Home Alone, Harry and Marv adopted Kevin McAllister. And we were supposed to think that this is a very heartwarming story.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a way to go out.
It's true. There seems to be some sort of purification act that happens by him stabbing her, even though he doesn't actually stab her. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, there's some sort of like, in doing that, he recognizes how wrong he was. And that's, I guess, supposed to, that blood, I guess, is supposed to cover all the previous sins, I guess. I don't know. You're right. I when I picked it, I was like, oh, this is kind of a rough one to go out on. But it was, like you said, it was so different than anything else that we'd read. I felt like we had to talk about it. So
no, I'm glad to have talked about it because it is different. But boy, the values dissonance between us and the Grimms. I don't know that it was ever clearer than in that story.
Yeah. All right. Well, what are we doing next month? We're done with the Grimms. What are we doing, Michael?
We are. We are moving on to Rudyard Kipling's Just So stories. And there are way fewer of them. There are 12 Just So stories. You know, Josh, we had talked, I'm calling an audible here, and you can tell me what you think about it. We talked about doing 3 days or 3 months for this. I think you're right, and we could do 2, because as I look through this, a lot of the pages in my edition are pictures. So the stories are only like 8 or 9 pages a piece. So I think we could do 6 and 6.
Okay, sounds good.
So next month for the Just So stories, and you should be able, I'm sure these are all available online. I'm sure they're public domain, but there's also probably 50 editions of them for anybody who wants to actually go buy one. I'm using the Puffin Classics edition. So for next month, we'll be reading How the Whale Got His Throat, How the Camel Got His Hump, How the Rhinoceros Got His Skin, How the Leopard Got His Spots, The Elephant's Child, and The Sing Song of Old Man Kangaroo. And
that's
we'll
be a lot of fun.
Instead of picking five each, we'll actually just read through all of them because there's only 12 of them altogether. So should be a good time. These stories are, you know, written by one person, so they are much more literary than most of the Grimm stories, and much more modern. I guess they're actually not much more modern in the sense the Grimms are writing their stories down in the 18 teens, and these are written, I think, in the 1890s, but they feel much more modern because they're not going back to some sort of wellspring of collective unconscious like so many of the fairy and folk tales.
Yeah, it's going to be good. It's going to be a good time. All right. Well, our press liaison is Christian Philippic, and we are on the old interwebs at christianhumanist.org. And you can help us continue this conversation by reaching out to us at beforetheywerelive@gmail.com. And we also want to encourage you to set your podcast player's dials to the Christian Humanist Radio Network. We've got a bunch of old shows on there. New shows, not so much. Although, make sure you tune in to the final episode of the Christian Feminist Podcast. Michael, when's that coming? Do you know?
Whenever I decide to edit it and get it up. So it might be the day after this airs if I feel like editing. I mean, this episode is now 2 hours long. So I don't know that I'm going to feel like editing another two-hour episode in 1 week. So it might be next week.
Okay. Well, we thank you for, I thank you for doing all that end of the work. Anyway, Michael and I know there's a great number of other podcasts you could be spending your time on. Thanks for spending these couple hours with us. So for Michael Farmer, I'm Joshua Altman-Schiffer. If you've not died, then you are still living.